Welcome to the Ideal Spaces Working Group podcast.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. We have a new podcast with John Roberts about public parks and public space. And John will tell more about it. We are from the Ideal Spaces Foundation, Grant Rainham and myself, Ulrich Gehmann, and are happy to have invited John for this podcast.
Okay, thank you, Ulrich. Yes, my name's John Roberts, and I'm based at Brunel University in London. I've got several research interests, but one interest is looking at the changing nature of public space and public parks in cities, and how they've been used both in the past and in the present by social and political movements to extend their democratic rights. So I've done a lot of work on this area, particularly in relationship to something we'll probably, you know, speak more about shortly, in relationship to Hyde Park in London and people's campaigns through the years to extend greater free speech rights in London and throughout the UK. And one other new sort of attached project to that, which I've just started working on, is looking at how monuments can be appropriated by people to extend their democratic rights. For example, how monuments can become meeting points for people to engage in protests and demonstrations. And one thing which I'm particularly interested in as well are more recent changes, well, I say recent, in the last 30 or so years, recent changes to public space and urban space in relationship to the rise of neoliberalism, and how neoliberalism and its ideology and practices have sought to impact on people's democratic rights, if you like, in public space.
I think this is a very essential point, and if you can line out this point a bit more, the changing nature of the public space and the relation of these changes to democracy.
Okay, well, there's lots of angles to that question, and lots of sort of ways one could look at the changing nature of public space. I think, and a lot of my, I mean, most of my examples will be to do the UK, obviously, because that's the context I'm most familiar with. Okay, so in relationship to the changing nature of public space and its relationship, I guess, to neoliberalism. So one guiding aspect, as I'm sure most people know, to neoliberalism is the idea that states should encourage and empower private enterprise, private business and private finance to not only invest in areas, but also often to take over the running of certain social amenities. And so when it comes to, I guess, public space, certainly in the UK, what we've seen in recent years, and this directly impacts upon people's democratic rights, is the what might, for want of a better term, be the privatization of what was once public space. And so one simple example of that is that local authorities have increasingly sold public spaces to property developers, for example, or to private enterprises, which have then built new shopping centres in what was once public space in a city or in a town. So what we've seen and what many people have noted, particularly in the UK, but I think it's probably throughout many other countries, is the rise of so-called quasi or semi-public space. What this means is that what was once public space controlled by a local authority that people could just walk into, or in terms of democracy and participation, if they wanted to, say, get a petition going and go into a public space to get people to sign a petition about some sort of issue they're campaigning on, whereas that was fairly straightforward and easy, now it is becoming harder because many of these public spaces are now owned and controlled by private companies, which have their own private security and so on. And so while, for example, a shopping center is normally a public space, so you can go into a shopping center, of course, to buy goods, to have a coffee and so on, it's not a full public space anymore because obviously it's owned and controlled by a private business. And so there have been some cases where, and also these semi-public spaces are monitored through private CCTV cameras and other forms of surveillance. And so there have been some examples where people have tried to go into these spaces, you know, maybe, like I say, to get a petition going about a local issue, but they've been escorted out of that space. And increasingly in London, there's many more what once deemed to be public spaces, which have been sold off to the private sector. I mean, one estimation, for example, in 2018 suggested that since 1979, around 2 million hectares of public land worth about £400 billion, and which equates to about 10% of Britain, has been sold off in the UK. And so, therefore, you know, you have this phenomenon going on in certainly in Britain, where more and more land, public land, is being sold off. And this also impacts on public parks as well. There's increasingly a crisis in public parks in the UK. For example, there's been some debate and discussion around how do we fund our parks today, because money has been taken away from funding parks. And so increasingly public parks are reliant on people volunteering in their communities to keep the parks going and to look after the parks. Or when it comes to a really large park like Hyde Park, which I'm sort of familiar with because I've done some research on it, increasingly these large parks in urban centres have to engage in commercial activities to raise funds to keep their parks, you know, going and to maintain their parks. So in Hyde Park, for example, they now have a annual winter festival or Christmas festival where they have loads. It's like a huge fun fair they have in Hyde Park around about this time of the year, sort of November going to December, that takes up huge areas in the park in order to raise, you know, money. And also in the summer now in Hyde Park, they have lots of big pop concerts. Now, it might seem, well, what's wrong with that? Well, I've spoken to, I interviewed a few years ago a park keeper who once used to be the head park keeper at Hyde Park. And he's from what he said is that many of these events, you know, sort of not exactly damage the land in parks, but certainly it means that it's a constant process of trying to maintain the parks and keep them in an orderly state after obviously hundreds of people go into them for these sorts of commercial events. But also Hyde Park is a park that should just be freely accessible to people. But of course, when you have these huge commercial events going on, large parts of the park are then closed to the public, if you like, or these commercial events occur and so on. So you know, there's been a lot of criticisms of these issues at the moment. So that's one way. Anyway, the increase in commercialization and privatization of public space has gone on across the UK. That does have an impact on people's democratic rights, if you like, because it means, like I say, they don't just have easy access to these spaces anymore. You have to go through private regulations, private security processes if you want to go into them to campaign on a particular issue.
This is a general point of importance. So when I may pose a question in this regard, What do you think is the? I have two questions. The first is, what do you think is the general relation between this kind of public spaces like parks,
yeah,
to a democracy? And the second question relates to this case example of Hyde Park, also what you presented also in the symposium.
Yeah.
And this relates again to cultural heritage. Also, an encompassing privatization does not only endanger democracy, to keep it short, but also cultural heritage.
Yes, yeah. So parks are integral to democracy and participation in major cities around the world and in many towns, not just in the UK, but in the US and across Europe, in the Middle East, and so on. Because public parks are open spaces that allow people to enter and to gather within and to meet up in order to debate and discuss issues of the day, and in order to have a visible presence when they want to when people want to campaign on an issue. And this isn't just in the past, this is in the present as well. So park, particularly in cities, become major points, meeting points for people when they want to protest about an issue. And so, for example, you've only got to think of in 2011, you see people taken to parks and open spaces again during the Occupy movement. That actually starts in New York in 2011 in a park there, where people were campaigning against austerity and against being blamed for the banking crisis that had occurred in 2008 and 2009. And that then spreads around the world. It comes to the UK, it goes elsewhere. And many meeting points for people during the Occupy protests were in public parks, because they're spaces where people where people know about, you know, they've often visited their local parks or parks in cities. And it's easy to publicize a meeting or a protest in respect to sort of going to a park for people to gather and to debate and discuss issues. And so in respect to Hyde Park, that's often been the choice for people to meet and gather in London when they want to engage in protests and demonstrations. And it goes all the way back in my research, it goes all the way back to the 18th century and beyond. And then you can trace people going to Hyde Park to campaign for democracy, participation and free speech throughout the 19th century into the 20th century. And even today, you still have people, you know, turning up every Sunday, many hundreds of people turning up to engage in free speech. People still gather there to have debates and discussions. So in terms of heritage, Hyde Park is one of the most well-known places, not just in London, but in the whole of the UK, for people to gather on a regular basis to engage in free speech. And what you've got to remember, it's not just your normal sort of political types who go to Hyde Park for these purposes. It's people who often don't get their voices heard in the public sphere. Often people from what might be called sort of more marginalized groups from different ethnicities, from different political persuasions and so on. They go to these spaces in order to practice and exercise free speech. But also at Hyde Park, you've got the famous Marble Arch Monument there, which is a military monument that used to be actually once upon a time the entrance to Hyde Park, but a roadwork sort of cut it away. But nevertheless, that's still a symbolic rallying point for people to meet up if they want to meet in order to engage in a protest or demonstration. So very, very recently, during the Israel-Gaza conflict, Marble Arch has been the choice for people to sort of meet in order then to engage in a sort of demonstration in that area of London. So these are sort of embedded in people's memories, you know, and through generations, these places, these public spaces and monuments and places of heritage are not only sort of symbols of an elite culture, if you like, they're also part of people's history. and people know about them. That's, and they become really important places for people to engage, like say, in ordinary forms of democracy and participation.
Which is an important aspect of cultural heritage too, no? So the democratic,
yes.
Well, let's say the popular aspect.
Exactly. So Marble Arch, like I say, it was constructed in 1837. Okay. And it was originally a celebration of Britain's Napoleonic victories. So it's a celebration of the Duke of Wellington and Lord Nelson against Napoleon. And it was going to be an entrance to Buckingham Palace. But as the palace grew in size, they had to then take down the arch because they felt it was too small for Buckingham Palace. And they rebuilt it in 1851 as an entrance to Hyde Park. Now, what's interesting, so although the Marble Arch Monument was a celebration of imperial military, in inverted commas, greatness, and also it was a symbol of royalty, as soon as it goes to Hyde Park, which by then in the 1850s became known as the People's Park, because radical social movements had gone there to try to campaign for greater democratic rights. You used to have mass demonstrations in Hyde Park. So as soon as Marble Arch gets relocated to Hyde Park, its identity absolutely changes. It then becomes almost like a people's arch. It becomes a place where ordinary people go to try to extend their democratic rights, to extend their voting rights, for example, and their free speech rights. So that's where the heritage of that arch suddenly switches from being a royal symbol and a military imperial symbol to suddenly becoming a people's symbol of democracy. So you get people buy the arch selling radical newspapers, for example. And as you get to the early 20th century, you have, huge suffragette marches, marches for women's rights going through the arch and so on. So in that respect, people overtake the narrative of the heritage of Marble Arch. And I think that's really important, is how ordinary people can reinterpret everyday heritage objects themselves.
And this is a good point also as regards the very character of heritage, cultural heritage itself. Yeah. It might change, it might transform, but it still is there. Plain and simple. And if this, if the very base, the architectural base, first of all, as a space of this heritage is destroyed, there is no heritage any longer possible. A transformation of the heritage or not. No, it needs a base. And if the base is removed, where's the heritage then?
Yes, it's Grant here. When I lived in London, I'm just bringing up, it's just of an interesting point. There used to be the Speaker's Corner.
Yeah.
And if I remember properly, because I lived in Chelsea, when I used to go over there, people used to take their little wooden boxes, just one individual, and start talking. Has that all changed also? Has the ability of an individual to stand and start talking about a subject and get maybe a few people around them, has that also disappeared there?
No, well, that's still going. It's not quite, at one point, Speaker's Corner, I'll say more about the history if you want in a second, in case people aren't aware of it, but Speaker's Corner used to be almost on every day. Really, it's just on a Sunday now, and particularly in the summer, if one got there about 2 o'clock in the afternoon in the summer, you'd still get a few hundred people and quite a number of speakers. So it's still going. It's the last space in London where people still regularly go to get up on a platform or whatever it might be. It's often step ladders or box or a milk crate or whatever, and start talking about something they want to talk about. There used to be many more spaces dotted around London and around the UK lots, actually. But they've slowly sort of declined for different reasons. Again, I can talk more about that in a second. But yeah, so it's still going strong, and it's still there. And in fact, you know, from when it was officially designated as a place where people could gather to engage what was termed back then public address, that was in 1872. It's still sort of going fairly strong and robustly. It sort of, I mean, in the winter months, obviously, you get less people there. But in the summer, on a Sunday, you still get a large amount of people. So, yes, it's still going strong. I would just add one reason I became interested in Speaker's Corner in Hyde Park. It's in the northeast corner of Hyde Park, right next to the Marble Arch Monument.
Right.
Is that my father used to go there in the he started going there in the mid 1970s and certainly by the late 1970s I went there. He used to take me there, my sister, a few times, and then he was actually an active participant there, became quite a well-known speaker, strangely enough, himself there. Yeah. And he was there for probably about 30 years or so. Wow. So I've got this sort of familiarity place, you know, I feel very at home when I'm there, because I used to go there, like I say, as a kid, and then, you know, as I sort of got old, still went there, and then I thought, well, this is a sort of fascinating place to do some research about, and then when I looked at it, at the history, it was absolutely astounding. I mean, that's relatively small space in Hyde Park does reflect the struggle and history of people trying to get free speech in the UK, which I can say a bit more about it, because it is actually a fascinating history there. But yeah, so I am very familiar with Speaker's Corner.
This all presupposes, as mentioned, this all presupposes the very existence, also the physical existence, the possibility,
yes,
of a public space to cultural heritage can unfold at all. No? What about this aspect as regards to the increasing privatization efforts? Are they really endangering, also cultural heritage traits? In the example of the Speaker's Corner, the Speaker's Corner is used still, no? So despite heavy privatization efforts. And one could say, okay, there are some cultural elements, at least as part of a heritage and of a common consciousness, that are still kept despite all odds.
Or yes,
a wrong conclusion.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, what's interesting about, so if we take the example of Hyde Park, and something like Speaker's Corner, the regulation of people going to these places has always occurred, whether it's today to do with privatization. The other thing to say about the UK today is that successive governments, both just before 9/11 and after 9/11, have introduced more and more regulations on people's rights to you know, enter public space for protest, demonstrations and free speech. So just to say, I mean, that there was an act passed only 2 years ago called the Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Act of 2022, which again empowers the police to you know, curtail, if you like, or constrain people's rights to protest in public space. So, for example, that act uses noise now as a category to intervene and impose conditions on an assembly in the UK if the noise results in what they say serious disruption to the activities of an organisation which are carried on in the vicinity of the assembly or march or protest. All I'm saying there is that that act alone empowers the police to judge if a demonstration is too noisy, you know, and then if they think it's too noisy or if somebody complains about the noise, then the police can intervene to regulate or to stop the demonstration. Anyway, but the point being is that if we look at Hyde Park, if you go back all the way back to the, you know, to this, say, the 19th century, the authorities were always trying to curtail people from going into Hyde Park to protest and to demonstrate and to exercise free speech. So, you know, in the 1860s, the government of the day then said to protesters and political movements who were going in to campaign for greater democratic rights, if you go into Hyde Park, we're going to say that you're trespassing on government property and we will arrest you. So that was in the 1860s that was happening. And yet, like you say, it was the people's willingness to say, well, no, this is the people's park. You know, we're still going to go in there whether you threaten us or not. And they did. So there's an organization called the Reform League that was set up in the UK in the 1860s to campaign for greater voting rights for people. Because you've got to remember, back then in the UK, not very few people had the right to vote, or it's very limited. So the Reform League was set up to try and extend voting rights to more people. And the government said, if you keep going to Hyde Park, you know, we will arrest you for trespassing. And the Reform League ignored them and just went in to Hyde Park in their hundreds to protest and campaign for greater rights. And in fact, it led to the then Home Secretary to resign, because they thought, right, okay, people are ignoring us and we're actually creating more problems here than it's worth. And so by the 1870s, the government relented and allowed people to go into Hyde Park to practice what they called public address, not free speech, but public address. So the point in going back to that sort of history is to say, yes, you know, there's always been constraints on people and their rights, and their right to enter public space, but it's exactly people and groups and their willingness to say, well, no, these are our rights, this is our heritage, we're still going to go into these places because we believe we have a democratic right to go into them and to, you know, to mobilize and campaign for greater rights. The other thing, though, to remember about heritage is that often people won't just appropriate existing objects of heritage like Marble Arch. They'll often say, look, we want monuments that represent us and represent our history. And so that's the other thing that people can do is to get heritage objects constructed and placed in public spaces that reflect their heritage. And that's something that's occurred in recent years as well. That's interesting.
Seen from this background, you spoke about, in your eyes, in your opinion, because you investigated it, what do you think are the major dangers today as regards an ongoing privatization and its threatening of the public space, for instance, parks like Hyde Park, where there is a cultural heritage, where there is a tradition of democracy practiced? Which are the major dangers today in regard to privatization impacts?
Yeah, okay. Well, I think, in terms of, when space is privatized or commercialized, and when it moves from public space to quasi or semi-public space, is then also subject to different, for example, measures of surveillance. So a public space will be subject to surveillance mechanisms usually operated by a local public authority, which is arguably more democratically accountable to the public. But because it becomes a sort of quasi-public space, the business or commercial entity owning and controlling that public space or semi-public space then brings in its own security apparatus, which are less amenable to public scrutiny. And certainly in the UK, they're less accountable to the public. So one, threat, if you might call that, might call it that, is that as well as the increase in privatization, commercialization of public space, you have new types of surveillance on public space that often isn't as accountable as it might have been in the past. Often also one thing about certainly the changing nature of public space in the UK is how much I was gonna say when you look at something like Hyde Park, how Hyde Park is run now is by a charity, is through a charity. Okay, so Hyde Park in the past, so if you go back 30-40 years, it was run by the state. Now it's run by a charity. That charity used to be a Quango body, but what this means is that the main remit of the charity, or one of the main remits of the charity, and in its previous incarnation as a Quango body, was that it had to raise its own revenue through commercial activities. And so often that becomes more, not exactly more important, but you see there the pressure on these organizations to keep trying to raise revenue, to keep trying to raise money. And again, that often means that, public space becomes much more of a profitable enterprise, a commercial enterprise. Often you get public space or even park space being sold off to property developers and so on. So that becomes an issue as well. And that can impact on public space in different ways. There is a related, I'd say, one issue, though, which is it's certainly in the UK that's had an impact on people's, sort of activity, if you like, to go into to public space to maybe engage in forms of democracy, which sort of, like I say, is related to the privatization agenda in respect to it. This is a more of a security thing, but in recent years in the UK, there's been a preemptive agenda by the police and the authorities to stop people going into public space to campaign for their democratic rights. So there's been a series of controversial cases here in the UK where the police have stopped potential protesters going into public space before they've protested. So that's another issue. It's slightly different to the privatization one, but that's a real problem that's occurred.
The combination of factors is interesting, and for me at least, after you reported it, the most interesting, since most dangerous factor is this, what could be called privatization from within. If a former organization devoted to the common good in the end, for instance, a park authority, is forced to generate its own revenues now, means its own financial substance.
Yes, there's a real pressure. I mean, in the case of Hyde Park, that occurred, through time. I mean, what was called the Royal Parks Agency was formed in the very early 1990s, and that was a Quango body that took over the running of the Royal Parks in London. Hyde Park is part of the Royal Parks. I mean, another Royal Park, for example, is Richmond Park, St James's Park, and so on. There's a number of these Royal Parks. Regent's Park is another one. So the Royal Parks Agency became it was a Quango body set up to run and manage the Royal Parks in the early 1990s. Before that, it was, the Royal Parks were run and managed by, a government department or different government departments. And in the sort of documents that set out what the Royal Parks Agency would do, one of the major parts of that was to, you've got to raise your own revenue. you've got to think of schemes in order to raise your own money, and you can't look to the state so much anymore to give you money, you know. So immediately there's a pressure.
Yeah, exactly. And this is a dissolution from within, so to
yes.
say.
Yes. Yeah, and that's part of the neoliberal agenda, of course, is the idea that, you know, the welfare state needs to be disassembled, and you have to get, you've got to put more competition in the state. You've got to contract out functions of the state. You've got to bring the private sector into the state to run public services. So this really occurs in the UK under Margaret Thatcher throughout the 1990s, sorry, throughout the 1980s. In America, it was under, of course, Ronald Reagan. And then you then see this process accelerate in the 1990s, you know, and the parks were part of that agenda, certainly.
Okay. Yeah, this is an interesting development. That's composed of the different factors you pointed out in your presentation. As regards the future of this common good, if we call this kind of parks and this kind of public spaces having a real public function for the public, if we want to call this, that is part of the common good. How you see the future of this kind of common good with an ongoing privatization? So if we would develop a vector into the future and develop a kind of scenario saying, what would happen with ongoing privatization with this kind of common good?
Yeah, I think at the moment, certainly in the UK, the austerity agenda that was established after the global financial crash 2000-2009 is still with us. And that obviously has had a big impact on funding public space and places like public parks. And for the certainly foreseeable future, that is still going to be with us, I think, undoubtedly. Parks, both local parks and big urban parks, certainly in the UK, under enormous pressure. Funding has been, you know, cut back for them. And when you look at parks in the UK, they're reliant now on volunteers keeping them going. So most parks, not just Hyde Park and not just other, you know, large parks. So there's a suburban park in London called Richmond Park. They all have their own what are called Friends of Parks groups. So Hyde Park has a Friends of Hyde Park group. Richmond Park has a Friends of Richmond Park group. There's where I live. There's local parks here that have Friends groups attached to them. And they do a lot of the work that obviously park keepers and the local authority would do to keep these parks looking nice, to maintain them. So, for example, Richmond Park now has a program of volunteer park keepers. Okay, so park keepers used to be paid, but if you look at somewhere like Richmond Park, which is a big suburban, London suburban park, it's now reliant actually on people volunteering to be park keepers. So I think in the foreseeable future, you will still see a lot of these issues in public spaces in the UK, unfortunately, and in places like parks. However, there are many groups that, you know, come together to try to make sure that parks are still there for people. So even when you look at, you know, these sort of Friends of Parks groups, many of those are very critical about the cuts that have gone on in parks. You know, and they will come together to campaign about, you know, getting more funding for parks and so on. And it's still the case that people still meet regularly when they want to protest and demonstrate in public spaces. You've only got to think recently in London, there's been regular demonstrations, for example, around the current Gaza and Israel conflict. And these are regular demonstrations in London, big demonstrations attracting hundreds of people. So, you know, it's still ordinary people still go into these places to try to practice, you know, democracy and participation. So it works in different levels, from people volunteering in their communities and saying, well, look, you know, we've got to come together to combat the cuts that have gone on in our public services, in our public spaces. And we've got a campaign, you know, for more funding here, to people still coming together at a city level to campaign on certain topics they feel passionate about. Also, what's interesting is that there's certainly in the UK, there's been new campaign groups that have sprung up recently, particularly around environmental issues, who are using quite innovative tactics in public space to get their message across. So if you think about a fairly recent environmental campaign group, Extinction Rebellion, there's another one, Just Stop Oil, another environmental group. And these activists are using very innovative techniques to get their message across and to campaign, you know, in various ways, using quite innovative tactics. So campaigners of the Just Sort of Stop Oil group have gone into art galleries, for example, and sort of thrown paint over art. I mean, they haven't ruined the art because they know that there's a glass, there's glass over the paintwork. So really, you know, the paint is going over the glass, not the art. But they've done that. Extinction Rebellion activists a few years ago climbed onto Marble Arch Monument. They scaled it and then unfurled a big sort of banner about, you know, saving the environment, etc. So people are still doing this. What's interesting, though, just a final point here, is that one thing about neoliberalism you've got to remember, and this goes back all the way back to when it came into Britain via Margaret Thatcher. One description of Margaret Thatcher at the time was that she advocated a free economy. So you advocate rights of business, or particularly of financial mechanisms and financial capital. But also she advocated the free economy, but also a strong state. Margaret Thatcher was all about having a strong state, particularly in the area of law and order. Okay, so as well as having lots of new policies that favoured private business, private finance, that empowered the City of London, she also introduced lots of legislation that sort of penalised people on welfare support, that restricted heavily trade union rights, for example, and also empowered the police, particularly when it came to regulating protests and demonstrations. And what you've seen in the UK in the past few years are a number of acts that have been passed by the government that, again, like I said earlier, have empowered the police to arrest demonstrators in various ways, shapes, and form, but also to engage in preemptive regulation of demonstrators, people, if the police suspect they might be involved in demonstrations, even if they haven't taken part. So that's part of the future as well, is a sort of lots of new legislation in the UK that has been quite controversial, in fact, because it's sought to, I guess, constrain and regulate people's free speech rights in various ways, shapes, and form.
Which is a general point in the discussion. One aspect also from critics of the neoliberal agenda is a neoliberal agenda is not truly liberal because it needs a strong state, in particular in the domain of a preemptive legal framework. Also, the state has to assist, as you described it in this Margaret Thatcher case, the state has to assist a further spread out of this neoliberal agenda in order to make it possible at all. on a large societal level as a debt of a state. No? The other aspect is, what about when we look at the future? There is no contradiction between, no inherent contradiction between authoritarian movements and a neoliberal agenda in terms of economy and social destruction. There is no contradiction.
Yeah. No. No, no. I mean, one thing about neoliberalism, what it's shown us is that it's really very, very flexible. It operates in many different countries and assumes many different guises and masks, if you like. So neoliberalism can operate in very authoritarian society. I mean, it has operated in very authoritarian societies, as well as in very sort of liberal societies. So I don't think personally there is a contradiction between. So if you look in Europe and elsewhere in the world, far right wing governments have and leaders have come into power. You know, they can follow and they do follow a neoliberal agenda.
Exactly.
So liberal democracy might follow a neoliberal agenda. They're not exactly the same agendas, of course, but they are sort of, you know, they're certainly not, you know, what might be termed as a welfare agenda that was established after the Second World War. You know, so that's the interesting thing, is that neoliberalism, I mean, if I just think about the UK, it's changed its form from Margaret Thatcher through to Tony Blair, through to sort of the austerity years from 2010 onwards, up until the Labour Party today. You know, they've all been neoliberal, but they've all been slightly different forms of neoliberalism. You know, so at the moment, I think it is still going to be with us for the foreseeable future.
You spoke of masks of neoliberalism. What is the real face of it behind the masks?
Behind the mask, the real face for me of neoliberalism is the attack. Well, originally it was the attack on the post-war welfare state. It was the idea that the state should not intervene in society to provide for people's needs, social needs. So I'll just give a quick example to illustrate that point. Part of the welfare state in the UK after 1949 was to provide housing for people. And so there's a program of what was called council house building to do with houses and flats. So people would always have access to decent housing. Now, some housing wasn't particularly well built during the 1950s and 1960s in the UK, but there was many examples of excellent council house building. When Margaret Thatcher came to power, one of her very early policies in the early 1980s was to argue that council house building had been a failure. She sort of took examples of quite badly built housing in the inner cities to say, well, you know, this hasn't met people's needs. What we need to do is to allow people to become homeowners, to allow people to buy up their council property very cheaply so they can be part of that sort of British dream of owning their own home. But what she also did, though, is that to people who didn't want to buy their council homes, she sort of penalised them by withdrawing certain benefits they might, state subsidies and benefits they might have had. So what you have there is a process of neoliberalism where you attack the welfare state in that particular policy, and you create, you privatise the housing stock. Now, what actually happened in the UK? Well, a lot of this housing eventually falls into, you know, a sort of private landlord's hands. You then had people renting more and more and having to pay huge amounts to rent a place to live. You have a housing crisis, which we've got now in the UK, and so on. So part behind neoliberalism, I think, is an attack on the welfare state, but also what motivates neoliberalism is what is often called as well the financialization of society. You allow financial capital to gain sort of what might be termed as hegemony. Okay, so in the case of housing, if you create a load of new homeowners, they have to take out mortgages. So, but then what happens is that mortgages start to be traded in financial marketplaces. They can't start to become part of a sort of financialized way in which traders earn huge amounts of money by trading not just on mortgages, but other forms of debt and so on. And so part of what's happened in the UK is we've seen this increasing financialization of everyday life, more and more people get into debt, and yet the sort of city traders have become empowered because they've sort of they there's more of everyday life that becomes part of their everyday sort of trading, if you like, in the city of London. So that's
a very important point. It's a very important point what you mentioned.
Yeah.
And as I could experience in Western European cities, it's this privatization mentality. The face behind the mask.
Yes.
became also a part of a new cultural heritage. Cities are products. So the whole world gets commodified, gets a product, and even cities are products. When city officials, for instance, speak about their city they are responsible for, the city is a brand, our city.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Incredible. It's a city and not a brand. This is a city, a place for people and no product in the end.
No, that's right. It becomes a brand, yeah. I was going to say that also happens. That's also related to a security agenda as well, because many cities brand themselves as being resilient. I mean, resilience has become a key word for many cities in which to brand themselves. And what that means is that cities can preempt risks in the world, and you can brand yourself like that. So we had the London Olympics in 2012, and London during this time was branding itself as being, hey, come to London, we're a resilient city, we're security conscious, we're preemptive, and so on. And so the branding there becomes not just one of profitable outlets for business, come to London, we're very business friendly, but it's also come to London, we're security conscious, we're resilient, we preempt risks and so on. So that's part and parcel of that branding as well. And just sort of going back, back to very briefly to the question of explaining neoliberalism, just to give an example from myself and to do with higher education in the UK. So when I was a student, I first went to university in 1990, I got all my education funded. So the state paid for my course and also gave me a grant to live on. Now, if you fast forward to students today, they have to pay over £9,000 per year just in their fee to go to university. And the vast majority don't get a grant either. They have to take out student loans. Now, this was put in place over many years. So, the way neoliberalism often works is slowly. Okay, it's a war of attrition. You make slow changes. But if you go from when I was at university in the very early 90s to today, what you see is this transition from me as a student then, as a citizen of the welfare state, to students today as private consumers of education, higher education, taking on and managing debt streams, debt. And so that's the transition to an identity, in students.
Yeah. This is important. This identity, I think, after what you outlined. I said, this is one of the most important points next to privatization in itself as a bare economic and hence social and political effect. It's the identity change. No? Mm-hmm.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Even I, as an individual, have to be a small brand for
to
market myself. Incredible.
Well, that's the interesting thing. I mean, when we relate it to digital technology as well, which we haven't quite touched upon, but one, what some studies show is that when it comes to, like you say, things like self-branding, well, social media is very good at this. So if you just think of Instagram, people can try to brand themselves through the pictures they take, the selfies they take, and how they sort of almost curate those selfies. People are often very, very careful what selfies to put on a social media site like Instagram. Often it's like, you know, showing that they're quite fun and that they're likable person, a person to be around, etc. And so this, so what some studies show is that rather than just being, you know, a sort of an everyday, you know, sort of harmless activity, which it is to some extent, many of these social media sites allow people actually, when you look into it, to brand themselves in certain ways, you know, in order then to get maybe job opportunities or other opportunities out there. You know, people do carefully use these social media outlets to do that sort of stuff. But you're right, you know, it's trying to make one into a self branding.
Yeah, which could lead in the effect to an encompassing social Darwinism of a new kind, no? As a possible scenario already implanted here in the present.
Yes.
The question is to address it. In your view, what is the relation? It's a complex theme, but at least if you try to outline it in its major elements, in your opinion, what is the general relation between the neoliberal agenda, privatization, and social media?
Okay, so it's a really interesting
identity and the loss of identity.
it's a really interesting question. I mean, there's lots of different ways to look at it. I mean, certainly. So if you look at the major media companies, you know, like Meta, which is Zuckerberg's one, and Google, and all these sort of big companies, I should say, in the US, the most valued companies on the stock market are the big digital media companies. I mean, a lot of those companies do brand themselves as in a sort of we say this before Elon Musk has sort of sided with Donald Trump, but a number of the others have branded themselves as in a sort of liberal way, if you like, almost like they're part of the hippie generation of the 1960s.
Cultural heritage of them.
So they've often, media companies, Silicon Valley has often relied on that sort of heritage, you know, of being cool, you know, of instigating what some people call as a sort of cool capitalism, if you like. And appropriating what's often deemed to be sort of slacker culture and that sort of stuff. But obviously they're ruthless, you know, these companies are ruthless in protecting intellectual property rights and whatever. There's a case at the moment in America where Google have been wrapped on the knuckles for monopolizing search engines, and they might have to relinquish some of that power at the moment. But so certainly, you know, neoliberalism is part and parcel of that sort of tech mentality of the big tech corporations, and yet it's sort of integrated with a sort of hippie type coolness as well to make it, you know, sort of attractive to people. I think when it comes to social media more generally among ordinary users, like I mentioned earlier, there is a self-branding that often goes on in how individual users use social media. Let's not forget that big social media companies rely on people freely and constantly using social media to sort of personalize their social media pages, to be engaged all the time, relentlessly on social media. And you know, big tech companies rely on people doing that freely. So I think there's that element. But the other thing that people have done, of course, is to use social media and digital technology to be very critical of tech companies, to engage in social and political movements. And so the Occupy movement, and just before that, the Arab Spring, was seen to be one of the first social political movements where people both went into public space to protest against things like authoritarian governments or about the austerity neoliberal agenda, but also use social media, use what was then called Twitter, for example, to give personalized accounts of their activism. And so so in many respects, social media, a bit like mainstream media of the past, will be used in very critical ways, and often ways to criticize different types of neoliberalism, and to be used by activists, and that happens, you know, even today. So it swings and roundabouts really in how this technology is used, but that's always been the case with media formats, I think.
Yeah, but interesting. Yeah, clear. It has always been the case, but the interesting point is, in fact, for a large public, the social media have become the new public space. No? It's no longer the park or the piazza mainly. It's social media, also, at least in terms of frequency of use.
Of course. I mean, that's well. What's interesting is when it was first, when the internet was coming of age in the 1990s, particularly the late 1990s, there was certainly even then a lot of discussion about whether this is the new superhighway. You know, it's the new public which is going to connect people together. And certainly, like you say, there's lots of other debate and discussion even today with social media about this is the new commons and so on. I think that yes, to a certain extent that is the case. However, I think what's interesting in the last few years is that people still recognize and still want to be visible in public spaces in order to get their voices across to others. And so it's a real sort of combination of things that I think it's yes, the recognition that there is, you know, you can sort of interconnect on publics in digital media, but at the same time, you do have to also connect in real life. Yeah. If you want to address certain issues and causes that are dear to you, and sometimes social movements that have just been online have sort of diminished somewhat, you know, and haven't been as successful as they might have been. It does the campaign work at an everyday community level of people meeting face to face is still really important. Can I just sort of add there one very interesting phenomenon that's occurred in the last 10 or so years is when social movements have actually tried to move into parliamentary politics and have become known as movement parties. So social movements which used to actually try to distance themselves from everyday sort of party politics, many now have actually moved into that arena and have now actually sought to campaign with ordinary people in their communities. And you know, start to engage in things like, you know, knocking on people's doors to say, hey, you know, we want you to be part of our movement, start to leaflet people, start to arrange meetings in communities. And many of these social political movements certainly use social media, but have recognized the importance of engaging in with ordinary people at that sort of face-to-face level as well. It's not just left-wing and progressive movements who do that. It's also quite right-wing and far-right movements who have done that as well. So that's quite an interesting phenomenon. It's happened in the UK. I know it's happened in Europe as well quite a bit.
If we transfer this to the public space, this would be, in terms of anthropology, let's say, this would be in favor of the public space also in the future. You need physical space with physical people meeting in a direct context.
Absolutely, right? Absolutely. I mean, I know in Germany, I think it's just the announcement of a new general election coming up. Is that right? And
yeah.
And there you have new parties, don't you? Well, not new parties, but you have, you know, both on the left and the right, parties that will use, obviously, social media, but they go out as well, don't they, into communities to try
to... They go into communities. They do both.
Yeah.
Okay. This is a very interesting frame as to what you lined out in our entire podcast up to now, no? A system consisting of different dynamic factors, partly interacting. What you would say, if you would have to give a summary, what's about the future of the public space, parks, in the future, in a positive direction, means what needs to be done, and what would be to have sustained in the future to sustain the very phenomenon of a public space as a common good.
Well, okay, so I think one way of answering that is the example of a project I've just starting, a new project, which I alluded to in my presentation, when we had the, you know, workshop on neoliberalism in Karlsruhe, which is to do with the regeneration of the spaces around Marble Arch. Now, that currently is being undertaken by, you know, business organisations. However, what they've done, and this is the first time it's occurred in an urban development organization and process, is to take seriously the heritage of the space of Marble Arch and Speaker's Corner and Hyde Park. So they're trying to regenerate the space through not just a commercial narrative, but also through a sort of people's history narrative and free speech narrative. Now, it's very early days. Obviously, who knows how it's going to develop into the future as such. But what's interesting there is that they are taking people's history very, very seriously. Now, there have been examples of other developments across the UK that have tried to, take seriously people's heritage, the same in the in the US and in Europe, where commercial enterprises will say, look, we don't just want to make this for the business community. We want to look at the heritage of the place and incorporate that heritage into what we're doing here. Now, many of these developments have been, I guess, criticized by just taking, you know, selected parts of a heritage but really developing a place just really for sort of commercial reasons. But I think in the case of Marble Arch, there's a real possibility, quite an exciting possibility, that actually for the first time, the words free speech and people's history is actually attached to a major development in London. So that's interesting. That could be a sort of a way forward of how these corporations could work in a very active way with people looking at the real history of a place and the sort of embedded people's narratives and how can that be be taken seriously in redeveloping spaces for everybody. I think also, in my view, a way forward, a positive way forward, would be to come out of the austerity agenda. Certainly, we still have it in the UK. The current government, the new Labour government, have indicated one or two sort of policies where they might try to come out of that agenda and provide more avenues for public funding for ventures and policies in the UK. And I think, you know, we really do need now to come out of that. Austerity, in my view, has been a complete failure. Certainly in the UK, you know, reports come out all the time that it's increased inequalities and social divisions in the UK. There's certain sectors that are collapsing at the moment because of austerity, health service, for example, and other sectors. So we've got a housing crisis. So, you know, we need to come out of that as well. We need to find other avenues, more, you know, more welfare avenues to support our public infrastructure. What you've got to remember is that the private sector often relies on the public sector. This often gets lost in the debates, certainly in mainstream media.
The new liberal agenda needs a strong state in the same direction.
Oh, it does. Yeah, absolutely. Just on that point, during COVID, there were various vaccines that were developed. Okay. Now, one study looked at one of these vaccines in detail to see, and the vaccines were all produced by private, you know, companies. Now, one study wanted to understand, where did they get the money to produce this vaccine? Completely private money, or was it public money? And obviously, a vaccine is produced by lots of studies that have gone on previously. You know, it's not just scientists there and them producing tests to make a vaccine. They're reliant on a whole history that's gone on, as well as present studies. And what this study found is that this particular vaccine they looked at, 99% of the money to produce it came from public money. Okay? It's really interesting. And yet the profits were made by the private company. You know, it's just, there's, you know, that's just one example of how the public sector will often support the private sector.
I think as regards the future, the example you outlined, so when private investors are seriously considering an existing cultural heritage and incorporate it in meaningful ways, as you had it, this would open a new road including a market mechanism and private interests with the common good. It could be a new way. In this direction, we plan a symposium next year to take place in Portugal. Very issue related to housing and related also to the inner city. This could be very interesting, this new approach you mentioned. And the other element you mentioned, we still need something like a classical welfare state or parts of it, in the sense of taking responsibility for some investments to be done. For instance, in the health sector, for instance, in certain public spaces. And this combination, and this new combination of private investment with tasks of the state, could be a very interesting road, because here we could elaborate many, many different working models for the future, how this combination could look like.
Certainly. I mean, Tony Blair, when he became Prime Minister in 1997, and he changed the Labour Party to something called New Labour. I mean, they did try to sort of speed along what they used to call public-private partnerships. So there was a sort of form of that, but the issue there was that the other thing that New Labour did under Tony Blair was to really empower, like Margaret Thatcher did, the City of London and the sort of increasing financialisation of life. So in terms of, for example, the university sector, they increased the cost of university tuition fees for students. They never really tackled the housing problem. So although they did have that public-private partnership agenda at the heart of their government, arguably, and what critics used to say is that they tended to favour the private even then, you know, over the sort of public. And so what you would want then is for the balance to go back more to the public, you know. If you're going to still have public-private partnerships, you need the balance to sort of go back to the public and for recognition of what the public sector does and how it helps and underpins a lot of the private sector. Yeah. It is fascinating, though. You're right. And I think things certainly in the UK need to change. There's a crisis in lots of areas of British society at the moment, not just health, but in many other sectors. And yes, things really do need to change. There's a lot of cynicism about parliamentary politics at the moment, as there are in many, many other countries. And so which is never particularly healthy, never what you want. And I think people, there's a general sense of feeling a bit disempowered and a bit fed up now.
In Germany, for instance, also, so there is to make it plain, there is a distrust in politics, and this is very, very dangerous.
Yes, yeah, no, of course, yeah.
Yeah, but I think this is taken to a bigger extent with the elections in the United States that just passed, for instance, where it seems that the current governmental gut all sorts of governmental plans and destroy them and try to turn everything as private as possible. I don't know if that can survive over time because, like, can the private area really sustain what the public needs, you know?
Yeah, no, of course. I think it is unsustainable. Absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, business is there to monopolize.
Right.
Make profit. That's what it's there for, ultimately, you know, to make profit. Now, you know, it can produce many benefits, of course, you know, in doing that. But at the same time, a business wants to make profit by monopolizing goods and destroying its rivals, you know, and there's many, you know, goods that if you can't make a profit from it, then, you know, a business won't invest and so on. But also the other thing to say is that, of course, when you look again at something like the 2008-09 global financial crisis, that, you know, where the global system actually almost collapsed.
Right.
There you see again the state having to step in, classically, you know, pumping in trillions of dollars into the system to stabilize the system, because at the end of the day, if you leave things too much to business, or particularly these days to financial capital, well, you know, we end up in an absolute crisis situation. And again, if you look at something like the COVID pandemic, again, trillions were pumped in to help out business. So yeah, I mean, there's always a role, you know, for the state.
Yeah, perhaps we need this new kind of economy you outlined. So it's taking cultural heritage really serious, and redefining in a positive way, redefining the role of the state where it needs to assist.
Yes.
And in this regards, perhaps we have to redefine what is profit. The profit is not only a monetary issue. How is the relation between profit and life quality, for instance, between profit for the common good and so on? So we would have to redefine profit also. The very essence of business.
Yes, I absolutely agree. Yeah, you know, what is true wealth? And obviously, if you invest in people, often they're prepared to be more motivated, and so on. And lots of studies show that. I mean, if people there's work done on, you know, people work less during the week, they actually can do more. You know, rather than working 5 days, you work 4 days, knowing you have 3 days off rather than two or one days off a week, and you're more productive in doing that. You know, so absolutely, you know, investments in the common good will reap many rewards, I think.
Yeah.
So, John, in summation, is there any points further that you'd like to establish, or?
Well, I would say that at the moment, just to sort of sum up, that I think, I would say for the future, one thing for the future is that it certainly seems to be the case more and more people now are cynical of the neoliberal agenda, I think. So whereas arguably when Margaret Thatcher came into power in the early 80s and throughout the 80s, neoliberalism was obviously more, it was newer. And there was that she never got over 50% of the popular vote, but nevertheless, there were many people, often across social classes, who bought into her project. Mm-hmm. You fast forward today, much of that project has absolutely, in my view, failed. I mean, she privatized all our public utilities, and there's a crisis in most of them at the moment.
Right.
So I think today what you have, again, going from the UK, is a lot of cynicism towards that agenda. The problem is, where do people go to, though? You know, sometimes, you know, they do go to the left and to alternatives there, but often they go to the right. And we see that in Europe. We see it a bit now in the UK. We've seen it in America. That's where people will go. So I think the future is open politically. And it's always there to make. But I think now with neoliberalism, I get the feeling it's deeply, deeply unpopular around the world. People are quite cynical towards it, the policies. When they do opinion polls here about, for example, public utilities, there's always a majority now that, look, we've got to nationalise these again. You know, we don't want them to be private. We don't want all this meaningless choice about who to go with, etc. People feel ripped off. Say there's a housing crisis over here. People are being ripped off by rents, high mortgages, etc. So, I think people are really feeling the effects of neoliberalism. But then that creates an open future in a way. You know, we're in uncharted territory at the moment. So it's all to play for.
Okay, very interesting. Many different aspects, in particular for the future, in a positive sense. It's uncharted territory. We could participate in charting this territory by finding out and discussing about new models deserving the name.
Yes, no, exactly. Many thanks. Yeah. Interesting, yeah.
Many thanks, John. And as said, we planned this symposium in Portugal, and we will keep you informed, of course.
That'd be great. No, thanks a lot for that. That'd be excellent. Yeah, well, thanks for the chat. It's good to speak again.
thank you, John. Thank you for all your time.
Cheers. Thanks, Grant. Thanks,
Ulrich. We stay in contact as regards the symposium and perhaps a second podcast on a related issue as regards new economic models. This could be really interesting.
Yeah, no, definitely. No, absolutely. I think, like we were just saying, that in a way that the future is sort of open at the moment, and there's lots to play for.
Let's find new ways and not only criticize the past.
Yes, exactly. No, exactly. Yeah, I totally agree.
Okay. Many thanks, John. You will hear from us. Have a nice weekend.
Yeah, you too. You both too. See, speak to you soon, hopefully. Bye.
Okay, ciao.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.